from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. This is the Chancellor's Report, featuring Mark Mone, Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Here's your host, Dave Edwards.
Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dave.
Good to have you here as always. I know that you recently delivered your State of the University. You know, there's State of the State, State of the Union. You have a State of the University, a plenary address. And I know you talked a little bit about some of the things that you're seeing on the horizon. What were your key takeouts of the presentation?
Well, Dave, thanks. This is our mid-year plenary, so we have two a year. And in the spring, I'm talking about what the state is and where we're going. And when I talk about the state, it's, of course, of our campus in the context of what I described as three different areas. The first one is really today, here and now, managing the budget. We have done a remarkable job cutting $30+ million out of our budget over the last year and a half to really bring our expenses in line with our revenues, but because of some of the ongoing challenges and some of the commitments that have been made over time, we'll still have to continue to reduce that further this year, but we're making great progress. But that's management, and that's really the here and now. The second theme was, you know, looking ahead, what are the strategic opportunities? Where is this campus going to go? And I talked about the process and the progress that we've made with a group that have been really dedicated a lot for the last couple of months working on exactly that. And so that's something that we'll be sharing with the campus in terms of the framework that they've created early next week. We'll continue to have open campus meetings and ask for feedback through our website. And then the final piece that I talked about was what I call essential elements. And those will be the continued focus on our Research One status, because that's so central to everything else that we do. The focus on student success and their not just graduation and their retention, the quality of their learning, but also the preparation for life after work or life after college, the world of work, the things that we prepare our students for. So internships, career preparation, jobs. We talked about the diversity and inclusion aspects on our campus, how we're doing things both on the employment side and the atmosphere around free speech issues, and then taking control and taking charge of our message. So those are some of the essential elements, as well as looking at the whole overall enrollment picture.
Which is significant. Let's back up a little bit. Have a little discussion about each one of them, if we could. So you've obviously made very good progress with the budget challenge that you have, and clearly that's been what's backed you up against the wall. But you're not done, and I know you've said that you're really looking at 2020, 2021 as the time at which you figure that your balance will be budgeted again. But that presumes that you're not facing any significant dips in enrollment or additional cuts in state funding.
We've tried to model in the enrollment projections as we see them. And because enrollments today are a function of the student class sizes for the last 6 years, the continuing students, new freshmen and transfer students, we can model such that we actually would anticipate that we will continue to have enrollment declines gradually, because even if our new freshman numbers go up, over the last 6 years, our enrollments have declined every year. So think about it as a staircase, and if every stair step is a little bit smaller every year, then you need that many years going forward in the exact opposite. You know, that you have to go back up that stair to get your overall enrollments back up to where they were. So we anticipate that we'll have continued declines for some time. We hope that we're modeling those accurately. We think we've got a pretty good handle. We obviously, from a state budget perspective, cannot weather another cut, certainly of the magnitude that we had in our last biennial budget. And we are looking at, again, alternative revenue sources that have to help on that. So you're right. There's some modeling, and we have to actually hope we've got that as accurate as we can.
You've been working with the regents, as have all of the other chancellors, and putting together a request that will go to the legislature eventually. And are you feeling good about that? Because you're asking for new money there.
We are thinking that that is a very reasonable request. And my discussion with legislators, the governor's staff and others suggest that this is in line with something that, that makes sense to them. They recognize the responsibility, the way that the budgets have been managed, and really the need, what higher education means for those in the state. So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic. There are some concerns. We will know more on February 8th in terms of the proposed budget and then, of course, through the spring. We've been having an awful lot of meetings with members of Joint Finance. We've presented to them. I had business community present to them at a major event earlier this month. We have brought that same message on videotape to the governor's staff, and that's being shared with others in the legislature. So I'm you know, hearing that we have a reasonably good shot. $42.5 million is aligned really well with things that the UW system has done a great job, I think, presenting the strategic need through so many listening sessions, through so many different campus constituents, people standing up in community saying there's value, there's need, the talent pipeline, the research partnerships, the economic development, where our students go, the impact that they have.
How different is that conversation now versus what it was 2 years ago? Because you're seemingly more optimistic now than you were when we had this discussion 2 years ago.
Well, 2 years ago to the date. To the date, we had heard the initial rumblings, and we did get the initial announcements of $300 million cut to the UW system. At that time, that was the governor's proposed amount, and that and a continued tuition freeze. So that was the largest by far budget cut ever received, because even in the past when there had been previous cuts, there had been tuition increases to offset that. So this was, you said, back against the wall. You nailed it. We were and worse, you know.
But what has changed? I mean, because back then the governor and the legislature was so focused on cutting funding. The criticism of the university was relentless. If your conversation now with lawmakers is different, what's happened?
Well, I think part of it is that at that time, part of the reaction – that was in part a reaction to some of the news about the reserves. The reserves that were seen as exceptionally high because there was a misunderstanding about how they had been portrayed and what the uses of those were. I don't think it's irresponsible for an organization to have reserves in the neighborhood of 5 or 8%. There does absolutely have to be disclosure of that. But for an organization that is over $6 billion in you know, overall size, scale, scope of budget operations, you need to have just knowing the way the cash flow operates. But part of the reason for where we are today, I think, you know, given your question, is that we're looking at a sense of we've worked those reserves down. They're more understood. They've been viewed by the Legislative Audit Bureau into their actual categories. And I think that there's a much better understanding of where those budgets are and how we operate. And frankly, we've trimmed budgets in a number of places. We've already been lean as a system, and certainly UWM is among the leanest research universities in the country. So there's not a lot more you can cut. But over the last 2 years, we've cut 20% of our administrative salaries. We've cut across the campus a significant amount, over $30 million. And that translates into almost 300 fewer people. But we're going to continue to manage the budget, and we'll probably have at the end of the next year another 100 people fewer at our campus. But what that's doing is it's you know, we're contracting because enrollments have contracted and our budget has contracted. But that's still, if you stand back and you look at this, you've still got this incredible, highly impactful campus, 26,000 students doing remarkable things, graduating 52 to 5,300 students a year for the last 6 years. Making such a difference because so many of our students come from Wisconsin, 85%, 75% stay here of our 178,000 alumni. And every employer that I talk to says, you're our number one source of talent. In addition, we have these research partnerships and community engagements that are unparalleled in terms of size, scale, and scope.
Will you continue to make investments in the research budget, because you've got the R1 status, which of course the university is very proud of, but that doesn't last forever.
Well, I hope it does, but you're right. Dartmouth lost their Research 1 status this year. I mean, there were 7 or 8 schools that you know, when you're in the top 115 and that number's pretty fixed, there are schools that come in, there are schools that go out. there are 4,665 universities that are in consideration for this. So we're in the top 115.
But chances are that you got to the R1 in better economic times than you're facing right now. And as you look at sort of the reassessment of the R1 in a few years, that means that between now and then you're going to have to put some money in.
You're talking about the most important challenge facing UWM. I think you nailed it. The R1 recognition that we received in 2016 is a function of investments that have been made, and there is a lag. There is absolutely a lag. What you're recognized for today is a function of what's happened over the last many, many years. And I'm very humble about that, that what I happened to be fortunate to be the chancellor at the time that, frankly, is the results of 60 years of work. It's not just the last 5 years or the last 10. It's really a lot of dedicated people who've been working. Now, if I can be immodest and take a little bit of credit, I've been at UWM almost 30 years. So I do value the things that you know, we collectively have done to really build an incredibly efficient and highly important research institution. The types of things that we will have to do and the critical investments will have to be better focused on those areas to be preserved and invested in to maintain that. And that's what we're doing is we have school and college discussions. There are three happening today in the College of Letters and Science. We had yesterday College of Health Science. Every day for the last couple of weeks, there have been one or more conversations. And these are deep 2 to 3 hour conversations with the faculty, administration, staff, in each of these schools and colleges to talk exactly about what are the priorities, how do we best align the resources in those units. And Dave, if you don't have priorities, if you don't have a strategic focus, then you're not going to get there. Mm-hmm. And so that is clearly important, as well as student success. So those are the investments around really the faculty retention, the types of things for graduate student stipends, things around future cluster hires, concentrations, areas where we recognize you have the most value add, the postdocs, the different categories that make for R1. And we'll do everything we can, but there's no guarantee. It's a tougher budget, certainly the toughest we've ever had in our history.
As we think about UWM, I mean, we're not in this alone. You're not in this alone. Your chancellors, I'm sure when you gather with chancellors and presidents from all over the country, they're asking some of the same questions that you are about the future. As you talk to your colleagues, your peers, what are some of the trends in higher education that you think it's not just Mark's problem, it's everybody's problem?
Yeah, you're right. You know, at the biggest picture at that level, the one response I would share with you that when we have, whether it's the UW system chancellor discussions or nationally when I'm at the conferences or when I'm on the phone and in webinars with different folks that we interact with, there are some very common themes and trends, and they deal with the role of technology and how that's changing education and what that means in terms of the physical footprint of campuses and distance education from a competitive landscape. Mm-hmm. As you see what's happening, for example, in the state of Illinois, it's not just that Wisconsin schools are really recruiting heavily. You have schools from Florida, California, New Jersey. You have campuses online really going after the Illinois markets. So that changes a lot of things. So technology, the demographics continue to be so huge. And so if you're in a southern state, you're actually in a pretty good situation right now in Texas, Arizona, from an enrollment perspective, Georgia. But if you're in the Midwestern states, boy, you're seeing population declines such as those facing most any state where you have anywhere from 5 to 7% fewer students graduating from high school. And that just means that it's a smaller pie. And so I think that leads to another trend, which is the consolidation. And probably I think we will see in the next few years, you've started to see some of the smaller privates. You'll see consolidations. You did see that a few years ago in Georgia, where from a state budgeting perspective, you did not have the support that was needed, and they really consolidated 2-year, 4-year institutions. They shut down some campuses. I could see that happening in a number of different states, certainly Midwestern states. I also think the rise of performance-based funding in the context of the continued decline in state education, I think we'll increasingly see that. We had an HLC accreditation that we're very fortunate to get the blessing for that. That's the Higher Learning Commission. And the accreditors from different states came in, and they were very surprised we didn't have that in the state of Wisconsin, and they came from a number of different campuses. And so I think that, as we're talking about future legislative requests, that will be part and parcel of it, from whether it's the legislature or the governor. So those are some of the big themes. The other one is that campuses are a microcosm of what's happening in society. And as we see, whether it's in the first 7 days or since the election, there's great uncertainty, and there's, as I think we can all appreciate, some political divides that are playing out broadly, but they really are focused on campuses around issues such as free speech or different views. And those are going to be something that as those play out in terms of different perspectives, that will be this issue of social consciousness and what is free speech? When does it become impermissible? Those debates are playing out, and I use debates in a almost a euphemistic way. They're not in a genteel scholarly discourse. It's rather emotional and unfortunately sometimes violent, and that's so unfortunate that's what I fear, and I suspect we'll have more of that on campuses.
So I suspect that one issue that you've thought about is and of course, you know, things are changing day to day in Washington, but the whole issue of sanctuary cities, sanctuary campuses, international students, the DACA program, how much of that concerns you in terms of the environment that you have at your university?
Well, we are a global university. We seek to educate, you know, global citizens. We have about 5% of our enrollment is international. Why that issue is so important is that any one category – so, for example, DACA covers for us about 250, the best we can estimate is about 250 students out of 26,000.
We should actually explain what DACA is.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't do that in my intro
to
the topic.
Sure. This is a program that President Obama put in place that covers it's for undocumented children after the arrival. So after their parents have arrived, children that are born in the United States but their parents don't have the documentation. So these are individuals who have either traveled with or been born here, and they are at risk if their parents are deported of having to go back with their parents or facing that uncertainty. If they've been born here and are citizens, then their parents are gone. So the protections that they've had are at risk is the question. And so the context of being named a sanctuary city or a sanctuary campus, you would self-declare that. And what's in the news this week is the threat of cities being stripped of that sanctuary status, or I'm sorry, cities that have declared themselves sanctuaries, such as New York or Chicago, maybe Boston, and I think, I don't know, 8 or 10, maybe 12 cities, they're being threatened with federal funding being lost. And so this will be tied up in the courts for a while. And meanwhile, campuses that have declared themselves sanctuaries, that basically says we will not assist and we will refuse to cooperate with any effort to deport our students. And there's a lot of discussion. If you read, I have to tell you, today, yesterday, I have been involved with meetings with our a number of different groups on our campus as we're sorting this out. And we are going to continue to maintain every aspect of compliance with the law. We are going to do this in a manner that is respectful of what our requirements are as a state agency. There's no question about that. At the same time, we want to provide all the assurances for our students and provide protection. And you know, a lot of this is consistent with FERPA, the federal education requirements for the privacy. So we are protecting students. But we also need to comply with every aspect of the law. So we are not going to declare ourselves a sanctuary campus, and I don't see that in the future for us. And I have to look at this and at the same time communicate to students from different countries that are in fear. And so aside from DACA, which really pertains to especially a lot of Hispanic students, we've got to look at this in the context of what we may have for Muslims tomorrow or other students in any particular context as every day is unfolding right now, and wanting to make sure we provide the necessary assurances to do everything we can to provide our students with that safe environment.
I wanted to talk about a new partnership which you and some of your colleagues from here in the Milwaukee area announced. M-Cubed is a cute little name. I'm going to have you explain that, but it involves a partnership between UWM, Milwaukee Public Schools, and the Milwaukee Area Technical College. What is it?
M-Cubed, starting with a name, Dave, is the exponential power of our three institutions to work together to strengthen the pipeline of students coming through our largest public school serving Wisconsin residents in the state of Wisconsin. It's one of my, and I think it's fair to say, Dr. Driver and Dr. Martin's signature events as we look at the leadership across our institutions. And what's powerful about it is that this is something that we all came into our leadership roles in 2014. And we formed a pact at that time supporting each other. And it's personal and it's got that deep commitment from the leadership. But it's also something where we have 150 plus people who are working in five different goal groups that have been committed for more than a couple of years now. And what we were able to talk about in the public launch this week is the results thus far. And what's neat, I think, about it is not only the relevance and the importance of it, because we know the importance of education for everything in this community. It really opens doors, and it means that we're going to have more graduates that stay here, more successful students from MPS that can go to MATC or UWM, or we're not exclusive. Any place in higher ed, right into the workforce. So we want to prepare for careers. We want to prepare for education. So don't get me started.
Yeah. So how does it work? I mean, what specifically is happening now? What exactly is going on to make that a reality?
Yeah. So what these groups have been doing is they've been working on, let me just give you one example, math preparation. So math preparation we know is foundational to the education and the advancement and so many other things. If you don't do well in math, you're just not going to do well in a two-year or four-year higher education system. It just doesn't work. And I'm not talking about just science engineers and mathematicians. It really is an applicable foundational skill if you want to go into healthcare and be a nurse, if you want to go into business, if you want to go into virtually any field, math is foundational. So
that's why I'm in radio.
So what is that mean? Well, it means if you just think about this, we have teacher shortages across the country. In particular, in science and math, we don't have enough. So can we help better fill that pipeline? Well, we have a two-year and a four-year education institution that can help focus on that. But in addition, you have people, if you don't have enough teachers right now, we're going to have to convert existing teachers. And as well, how about existing math teachers that might not be as updated on the curriculum that is being taught and how to best prepare students for what they're going to have? So the alignment of math, the preparation of math teaching skills, those are just a few examples. That's one area, and that's a part of a larger goal, which is around curriculum alignment. So that's one example. Having parents involved and having an environment, because we know in both MATC and UWM situations, we have a lot of first-generation students, so they don't have the benefit. And I'm a first-generation college student myself. I didn't have siblings or parents that knew about saving for college, for preparation, and how you really have to have your life lined up in terms of work-life balance. So really getting parents involved and getting them more educated and helping fill out the FAFSA form. That's the free application for financial aid. That's foundational to accessing grants, Pell Grants, and other things. So increasing the Pell Grants. But there's a cultural component too that we've been working on, and that is getting students at a very young age, and I'm not talking about juniors or seniors in high school, I'm talking about elementary and middle school, getting students to start thinking about and seeing the relevance, the instrumentality, if you will, the paths that education opens up for them. So getting students more into interns and having more business connections at an earlier age. Those are just, I'm just scratching the surface. There are so many things our folks have been committed to doing to really make a difference, to strengthen that pipeline. You're talking about 140,000 students. This is our future. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a moral imperative here. If we didn't do this, if we didn't say, we've got these great assets, we've got resources such as our faculty, staff, and the commitment, why so many of us are here in Milwaukee wanting to make that difference in an urban environment, and we look at the plight, we look at the challenges in Milwaukee in particular from a national statistics perspective, joblessness, poverty, the incarceration, crime. This is a huge part of the answer. So it's long term. You're not going to see in 1 or 3 years massive changes overnight, but we're already seeing progress. And this is the type of thing that I hope everybody can help get behind, because the alternatives are grim and bleak.
Yeah, it's important to the community, I would think. So you've shared a couple of things you've been involved in. What other meetings, what other activities have you been involved in the last month?
Well, some that are pretty neat, even though they're work-related. I have to tell you, one of the highlights was being able to bring a lot of our partnerships together to showcase for the Joint Finance Committee. Senator Darling and Representative Nygren were treated to really a display of having folks from Johnson Controls, A.O. Smith, Water Council, our Entrepreneurship Center, hearing from people like Tim Sheehy at MMAC, Julia Taylor at Greater Milwaukee Committee, talking about the power of UWM. I couldn't have been more proud. And then helping carry that story to the governor's staff and really making strong case for UW system and UWM. That was really neat. Another activity was we had our alumni board retreat on Friday night a week ago. And what's neat about this group is they spent the evening together and then the whole next day planning their future for ways they can support and engage. Mm. What was powerful for me was hearing the story from every one of them about what their memorable experiences were and how UWM was that inflection point in so many people's life. And I heard this theme over and over about how I wouldn't be where I am today without the education, the quality of the faculty, the experience. There's the fun stuff, like I met my wife in the library. So much of that. I can't believe what that library has done for a lot of families. But where people have gone, you know, it's just remarkable. So that's really invigorating. And then another great experience that was something I don't think I've talked to you about was having this showcase of our interns at Rockwell Automation and just blown away. In my whole time at UWM, this is one of the highlights to see how proud the company is of where our students are at, where they're going at a company like Rockwell around the world. And just so it's great to have those types of experiences, lots and lots of pride points.
Last month on our program, we referenced the fact that your dog Max was a new star because he was part of your video. And I heard Max had a little health issue.
How's he doing? Sad. I have to tell you, Christmas Day, he woke up and he was fatigued. And then I got him to the vet the next day because it was a real tough day getting him to move up and around. And as it turns out, he's got hemolytic anemia. And this is something where basically the immune system, for whatever reason, says those red blood cells are bad guys and gals and goes on the attack. So he's been Max is literally on steroids today to suppress his immune system. He's pumped up. He's eating like crazy, drinking like crazy. But he's survived. He's on the path to recovery, but it is a 4 to 6 month thing. He's in contention for the Oscars. You know, he's doing so many videos, so I got to keep him healthy.
Max the Wonder Dog. You know, you and I were talking on the way in. You lead such a busy schedule, as do all executives in your type of position. But I learned today that you are a voracious reader. What do you read?
Well, I love fiction and nonfiction, and I never have time to read during the day. So it's really for me a transition between.
You don't have time during the day to read?
Imagine that. So it's really that transition from, you know, you work late every night, and then it really helps to kind of calm and get you settled down for bed. But you know, there's always some fiction and nonfiction, and there's, you know, some favorite authors. You know, whether it's on the fiction side, somebody like a Carl Hiaasen, who does a lot of like Florida kind of, you know, fiction that's got this environmental bent to it, or a lot of mystery thrillers, Michael Connelly and Stephen Cray. On the fiction side, that's pure escape. But I've also got some nonfiction that typically is involved. And one of the things that I do enjoy is, you know, just always thinking about things that are not as work-related. Sometimes they creep in, like the one right now is it's Ivory Towers to Glass Houses, and it's written by Andy Policano, the former dean of the business school at Madison, and he went on to become kind of the dean's dean. He was one of the leading deans in business schools, and he's written a lot about higher ed and really the importance for strategic focus. That sometimes is a little too close to work, so I like other types of nonfiction. Like right now, Sapiens is a pretty interesting book by Harari, and he's talking about how we evolved and really fascinating, kind of like guns, germs, and steel in terms of how did different societies, you know, migrate? How did they get to be successful? What causes societies? And I know there's controversy in these different circles, whether it's in the biological and anthropological side. But to me, that's interesting and fun. But again, it's transition and survival.
We're going to have to make the Chancellor's book review as part of our program, I think. Interesting. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thanks, Dave.
We are out of time, but once again, thank you for joining us. Mark Moniz, Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We'll talk to you again next month.
Delighted to be here, Dave. Thanks, as always.
You've been listening to The Chancellor's Report featuring Mark Moni, Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. If you would like more information, go to uwm.edu/chancellor.